Hello and welcome to the Built Academy podcast. I'm your host, Carl Storms. We hope you all had a healthy and successful start to the new year. We at the Built Academy are kicking off 2021 with new compelling series of monthly podcasts just for you, the Built Academy listener. We start the year with David and a Built Technologies podcast. Welcome, David. I hope you had a great start to the new year. So with this episode being about BIM technologies, what exactly is it that you're working on for us?
Hey, Carl. In this month's episode, we're going to go behind the scenes of two successful internationally implemented BIM technologies and meet the founders and driving forces of BIM technology in the building industry. We'll be hearing from two industry experts that made the giant leap from a more traditional building industry to the future world of shaping our built environment. We'll be going over things like what motivated them to become technology innovators, what drove them to develop technology, what issues and traditional skills have they encountered in the past and how they fixed them, and what obstacles they still face and foresee, and how we can overcome them as end users of these technologies. Two very compelling stories of two inspiring building industry experts and technologists. With more than 30 years in the industry, as CEO and co-founder at Unify, Dwayne Miller is focused on journeying with AECOM leaders in BIM content management, distribution, and project health strategies. Based on his own experience as an electrical engineer on prominent projects across the globe, including Bellagio, MGM in China, Borgot in Atlantic City, and Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, Dwayne has led the charge in developing Unify's industry-leading cloud-based platform that saves each end user 80 hours per year.
Okay, let's jump into the interview with Dwayne Miller.
Hello, Dwayne. Happy New Year. Welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me today. I'm sure our listeners would love to get to know you a bit better. So how about a bit about yourself? How did you start off within the building industry?
Well, actually, I started right out of college. I was electrical engineering major and was on a military scholarship. And so right out of college, I went into a design build squadron in the Air Force for the U.S. Air Force, served there for 3 years. It was a great experience because it was interesting because I showed up my first day of work and the colonel who commands the squadron tells me that you're responsible for all the electrical design and construction for our 500 person worldwide mobile squadron. So I was like, okay, I just graduated. are there any manuals or are there some books I can read? But at any rate, it was really good because I was working with guys who were actually doing the installation. So I would do the design, then work with them, and they would point out all the things in my design that was wrong, and I would fix it. But learned a lot of hands-on as to the point where by the time I got out of the Air Force, I had my journeyman electrician license, my master electrician license, and I was also ready to sit for my professional engineering exam. Got out, went into private practice, decided rather than go the contracting route to be an electrical engineer and designing buildings. You know, I'd always kind of like design. I like building things, interesting to go from being in the military into the private sector. It was very, very, very different. But worked for JBA Consulting Engineers, was a company in Las Vegas, which was where I was stationed when I was in the military. Worked with them for a year, went to Colorado for 4 years, worked with another smaller firm there, which was really interesting because I was, you know, kind of at the ground level. I was a partner in the company. And it was, you get the work, do the work, figure out how to get the design done, how to get more work. So there was a lot of business experience that I picked up as I was kind of advancing in my engineering career. And I got my PE in the mid-90s and then came back to Las Vegas in 97. And I was in Colorado, so Vegas coming back to was a little bit of a challenge. But then when I saw all the projects going on, we were working on projects like Bellagio, Mandalay Bay. We had done all the Mirage, Treasure Island. So it was kind of a candy store for an engineer and really, really enjoyed it and started moving more into leadership. And towards the end of the 90s, early 2000s, started really kind of taking the company over as opposed to just leading the electrical group. So I was an owner in the company. And really started to think about how we expand the business. So we went from about 28 people in 1997 and started really growing the company in early 2000s and started to go from just being in Las Vegas and in Orange County, California, We actually ended up, I'd love to tell you strategic brilliance, but we ended up in Asia, and that was because of Wynn and MGM and some of the other developers we had worked with in the US, and went ahead and started growing the group. And fast forward to 2016, we had about 250 people. We were in Hong Kong, Macau, Ho Chi Minh City, doing a lot of work in Australia, plus across the US as well, between Vegas, California, Phoenix, Florida. So had a good growth trajectory. Sold the company in 2016 to a publicly traded company. It's funny because we had really started to overlap a lot. I started to overlap a lot into technology as we started to migrate towards building information modeling in early 2000s. And that's really where Unify, the kernel of Unify, or the seed of Unify, actually started.
In terms of your personal migration experience, what did you feel was missing in your traditional field of work?
Well, I think one of the, there's a couple of different things that were frustrating and difficult. One is the when you look at the technology and the shift that we made, particularly to building information modeling. I was around when we started. We were still drawing on Mylar, and you know, I went from drawing, we were drawing by hand, and then we just migrated that to the computer with AutoCAD. And that was a transition, but it wasn't as disruptive as the building information modeling transition was. And I think a lot of that has to do with the mindset of the domain. I think that, you know, as an architect, I was the owner of an engineering company. We're investing in the software. We started investing in Revit in early 2000s. And, you know, we underestimated the real difference between going from a 2D graphical symbology environment where you're using symbols to illustrate, you know, the build and the objects, to building information modeling, where now it's not just 3D. I mean, there's a lot of benefits from 3D visualization, but it really comes down to now it's a 3D visual database. And when you think about the people who would work in the CAD environment, you know, they could do a lot of things in CAD that didn't require a lot of deep domain context in terms of how things get built or how things get put together. And I think as we move to building information modeling, what we found is that you can't just take a CAD drafter and turn them into a building information modeler. It's a very different, there's got to be context and understanding of how, because you're virtually building. So there's a whole different level of context that was required. And also the technology, you know, it was tough in the early days, one with adoption, you know, there were challenges with the technology itself. And one of the things that frustrated me as a business owner is I'm making this huge investment. And then on the back end of that, I had a lot of overhead associated with people learning a very complex tool. And so when we adopted the technology and started migrating towards away from CAD and more towards building information modeling, it created a lot of challenges for us because the whole industry is based on velocity. Everybody is really worried about getting their projects done, getting them out the door, getting it built, getting it into operation. I've talked to a lot of people who are external to the domain. You know, they're not in the building industry, and they kind of perceive that, oh well, it seems like the construction industry is really, and that's the architects, engineers, contractors, and even the owners. They're very technology averse. And it's like, well, no, they're not technology averse. You go to a job site, you're going to see superintendents and crusty old contractors and architects, engineers, they're all using technology, but the technology has got to really work. It's got to kind of lean into the way that they already do things. Otherwise, the poor person who's trying to push out this new technology on my firm, for instance, met a lot of resistance because it slows people down. And if the tech is slowing people down, then adoption becomes you've got a lot of inertia in the adoption process. So one of the things we really looked at is, well, how do we just help? Because we believe in building information as a technology. And we think, you know, we've kind of got an obligation as an industry to make sure that whatever it is that we're doing, that we're creating something and we're optimizing the built environment in a very responsible way, because I mean, at the end of the day, that's going to be the legacy that we leave for the next generation that's going to inherit what we leave them. And I think our decision was, well, how do we help this technology so we can actually deliver on that. And that kind of ties to Unify's why. I mean, it's really, how do we help people really build a better now and enable a better future? And the now, it's got to be both and. I mean, you've got to be able to help people be better at their job today. And you also have to be thinking long term as to, okay, what's the next in the technology that's going to help them in the evolution towards better. So that's a very broad answer to your question. But what we saw is that there were some really big challenges with content in particular. And I ran into this firsthand as we were in mid-2000s, we were working on a very large project in Las Vegas, and there was a data center that was at the base of a 2,300-room tower. Well, if you know anything about towers, all the infrastructure collects right underneath. Well, that's where the architect had decided to put the data center. That's the space that we had. I talked to the architect and I said, look, we really need to model this because it's like a Swiss watch that we're building here. And there was, ductwork and plumbing and fire protection, electrical, big mechanical equipment. So there was a lot of things that had to be coordinated in a very tight space. And so as we did that, we were granted an additional services to do that work. And we got into it probably 3 months into it. We had spent like three times the additional service. And I was like, what is going on? And I ended up talking to my modelers and my people who are working. I said, well, what are you doing? Why is this costing us so much? I said, well, we've got to build all this content. I'm like, what do you mean you're building the content? Why don't you get it from the manufacturer? Well, the manufacturer doesn't have it. I said, you've got to be kidding me. So I start calling manufacturers. And when I mentioned BIM to them, they're like, what's BIM? This is in the pretty early days. And so the light bulb kind of went on. It's like, well, if we're really going to get this technology to move forward, you've got to solve the problem at the object level. I mean, people have to be able to get the tools out of their toolbox and deploy it on projects. And those tools are really BIM content is the basic building block of the overall model. And if you don't have the basic building blocks, you end up with being limited to really visualization because you're not loading the objects in the model that are an accurate depiction of what's going to become a reality through the build. So we initially started to build content. I started to have a lot of conversations with manufacturers. And as we're building all of this content, we worked with a lot of Caterpillar and a lot of other manufacturers that you'd recognize the names. And really helping them get to the point where they had some resources that they could give to the industry to fill that toolbox. And then we started to really see that, okay, well, a lot of content has been developed now, and what do you do with it? How do you version it? How do you have a single source of truth, which is, it's an overused term, but it's a valid term. So we started to realize, well, the real problem that we have to solve is we've got to help people. One, we got to get content. Two, once they have it, how do we help them version it? How do we help them store it? How do we help them make sure that they're able to structure data sets within it? So we started really morphing towards, we need to solve a bigger problem here. We really need to help people be able to integrate, a tool or a platform into their workflows. It's going to help them find these assets that they have. It's going to help them kind of corral all of them and aggregate them as opposed to having, 20 different silos of content, which really kills standardization because you have no idea what people are putting into these, what they're deploying in models. So we quickly figured out that, okay, we need to solve the content management problem. And that's when we started to, initially we developed on-premise with Unify. And then we, if we were going to solve even the problem for my former firm, we had multiple offices around the world. So cloud was the direction we had to go. So we quickly migrated to cloud. And as we've evolved in our journey, we found more and more, okay, the content now, if you can manage it, that's great. You can find it, you can search it, you have analytics on how it's being used. But the next step in the whole growth process for us was, well, how do we help people get control of their data? The shared parameter file that is really the schema for their firm, how do they make sure that that's being validated, governed, enforced, and utilized? So that was a bigger part of the challenge that really evolved us more into a BIM data platform, specifically at the content and the object level.
I'd love to hear a bit more about Unify Lab Solutions. What are some of the challenges there? What do you guys hope to achieve?
Yeah, I think one of the big challenges, and I think one of our advantages is we've got a lot of domain expertise. I mean, I've been in the industry 30 years. Our product manager, you know, Megan Green, she was a design technologist. She's also an electrical engineer, was working on buildings. So we really have a lot of empathy for the struggles that our users are going through, whether it's at the AE level, the contractor level, or the owner operator level, or even the BPM. And it's not, you know, one thing, you know, get your content built. Okay, now you have your content, you've got your toolbox assembled. Okay, now make sure you can manage and govern that. Now, as this content gets deployed, well, now what? Well, who's deploying what, who put what, when, where, that kind of information. And particularly, you know, we had experience with model crashes where, you know, a model crashes and poor Megan would have to run around and ask, try to find out who synced the model last, you know, what did you do? Who touched what, you know, what did you insert? And what we really look to do with project analytics in particular is daylight that information. So each sync to central, we capture the data. We can tell you what user did what, when, and where in the model, so that, you know, it's not an Easter egg hunt to try and figure out, okay, why did the model crash? You know, and just something as simple as that. You think about the frustration when you've got, you know, 8 or 9 users who are all working with the model has crashed, and they're, you know, twiddling their thumbs while they're waiting for the poor design technologist to try to put the fire out. So it's things like that that really led us more and more to, you know, okay, help them get their data structured. We need to do that. But then we've got to enable them to be able to visualize it in a way that can actually help them be better at what they're doing. And, you know, project health indicators is another thing that we do because, you know, you need that. You need those analytics to understand, you know, okay, well, how is my model? And everybody's health scores are a bit different depending on what's problematic within their ecosystem. Giving them the flexibility to kind of set their own, you know, set what their thresholds are really enables them to tune the analytics to what matters in the context of their specific ecosystem and their workflows. So I think, you know, a big part of what we're trying to do is help them get information that is going to enable them to be more efficient and also enable them to evolve, you know, and go further in their BIM journey. And there's a lot of things we do on the analytics side in terms of, you know, we're migrating more and more to where we're getting very granular in terms of what we can do from a data standpoint, particularly even from a search. I mean, you wouldn't believe how crucial search really is, because to be able to find what you need and find it fast and get it in the model and be able to do that in the context of your workflow and in the way that you're already behaving. Because if the product requires a behavior change, people won't use it because they're not going to change their behavior unless somebody is really pounding on them to make them. And one of the things that we really look to do is make sure that whatever we're doing with product, and this is where the context for the domain comes into play, whatever we're doing with the product is kind of leaning into those natural workflows and working, journeying with them, as opposed to trying to get them to, you know, become, to do things in an entirely new way. You know, the industry will take change incrementally, and it's not a knock on the industry. It's just a function of the fact that it's all driven by velocity. The faster people are able to get their job done, you know, the more profitable firms are, the more profitable the contractor is, the better it is for the owner. And that's, you really have to kind of be that both and in terms of journey with them in the trenches of execution and make sure that they can get the analytics that they need. They understand if they have a model crash, how to troubleshoot, diagnose that, to solve the problem quickly, how to find what it is that they need to, you know, deploy on the project. I mean, there's all those sorts of problems that, you know, are near-term needs in the trenches of execution. And we also have to be thinking about things like parameter mapping. And what about getting the non-technical user pulled back into the workflow? I can tell you, people can't see me, but I got a lot of gray hair. And part of the challenge that I had when we started migrating towards building information modeling is the complexity of the technology was such that I couldn't really engage. I was kind of pushed out of the workflow, which I found really frustrating. Even with CAD, I didn't do CAD, but I could stand over my drafter's shoulders and kind of point. We would call it, oh, we're going to design draft here. But with building information modeling, the complexity of the technology pushes a lot of senior subject matter experts, whether it's in the contracting side, the owner side, those non-technical people who have a lot to contribute to the workflow are kind of pushed out. So one of the things that we're looking at as well as we evolve our platform is making getting to a point where someone like me can pick what I want from a library of objects, can do some basic instruction, or I can do some attachments, and I can take that information and give that to the modeler. Well, now I'm directly influencing what he's deploying, and I have visibility into this asset set that we have, all these virtual assets that right now are kind of a big black box. We used to call it the dark BIM. And we really want to shine a light on that and put it in a format with a UI that someone like myself, you know, I can work with. You know, I don't work in Revit, but I know how to shop on Amazon. So if we set our UI up like an Amazon shopping experience, which is what we've been doing, and with the web migration that we're going through, it's going to become really open up a lot of opportunities for the senior subject matter experts and the non-technical people who are concerned about the virtual assets, but unable to interact with them. It's going to pull them into the workflow, which I think is good for the industry, because what you don't want to do is take your most experienced, you know, most seasoned veterans of the industry and actually kind of have them be the workflow is kind of obfuscated from them, or, you know, the model becomes a black box, is a black box to them. They don't know what's in it. And we want to change that. And really, again, it gets back to enabling that collaboration between a non-technical user and a really savvy, you know, somebody who's very savvy in Revit and very good with technology doesn't have the benefit of 20 years on construction sites getting beat up by contractors, or, you know, dealing with difficult owners. And they just don't have, and it's not their fault. It's just there's certain things you can only learn experientially. And a lot of our domain, and it's different, you know, region to region. I mean, you know, doing work in Hong Kong or doing work in New York versus LA versus Las Vegas, it's different in each domain. So the more we can take that experience and leverage it into the workflow, I think we get to better outcomes. You get better models, you get better buildings, and you get just a more optimized built environment, which is what I think we're all shooting for.
You already touched on this, but could you give us a bit more of an in-depth explanation of the obstacles you're currently facing within the building industry?
You know, I think a large part of the challenge is just resistance to change. And that's a natural thing, and particularly for our domain, that's all velocity driven. Again, it gets back to, you know, if I can do it faster this way now, why would I change? And that ends up being kind of a resistance point and an inertia point. We saw it a lot more early on, and quite frankly, we were a little bit early with our platform, and there was a lot of headwind. And what we've seen, I think, in the industry in general, you know, BIM was probably early adopter, the early majority when we really started to drive our platform. And what we found is and it's different regionally. I mean, Australia is very advanced in terms of where they're at. The U.S. is pretty far along. And, you know, Canada, Europe's pretty far along, but it's, you know, it's different regionally, and particularly, you know, we had offices in Hong Kong, and you know, I know there's government mandates for building information modeling there and in Singapore, and it's a difficult transition to make, because, you know, the resistance to the change, if I'm doing something that works, why would I do anything different? And so there's got to be a bigger why behind it than just, hey, we're going to change the way we do this. The reason we're doing it is because we want to, you know, build a better now and enable a better future. We want to, you know, have an optimized built environment, and we're not going to get there following legacy workflow. So I think the resistance to change was probably, and we don't see it as much today as we used to. And I think the other obstacle sometimes too is the people who are living the struggle, the Revit modeler or the BIM manager. A lot of times they don't have the ability to get the budget that they want, because the executives that they're trying to get that budget from don't understand the problems that they're having, and they don't have context for it. And, you know, it's difficult to communicate that up when, hey, I'm asking for a spend. Well, why do you have to have this? Well, aren't models getting done? And as an executive, I would be the one posing this question to poor Megan back when she wanted to spend a bunch of money on technology. Okay, well, what are we doing now, and why do we need to change? And I think you know, it's a challenge for the design technologist and the BIM managers or even the Revit users to get the executives who don't work in the platform to understand the struggles and the benefits, and, you know, So I think there's that element of it too. And that's not just in the AE, that's at the, you know, you see it at the contractor level and also with a lot of the owners we work with. You know, we work with a lot of owners that have large prototypical asset sets that they want to make sure get deployed appropriately region to region, because they don't want to be, you know, buying 15 different types of, you know, hand dryers for the restrooms or whatever. And, you know, they also have the least amount of Revit modelers typically on the owner's side. You know, the contractors and the AEs are going to have more people either in their virtual design and construction group or in their BIM group within the AE firm. So I think there's the challenge of that conversation between the people who actually understand and utilize and live in the trenches of execution with the technology versus those who are approving the budgets. And you know, if they're not really sold on the story, or they don't see the bigger picture of why they really need to migrate in the direction they're migrating, it creates headwind within the industry, particularly if it starts to slow people down. And this is the real critical thing, because if your design technologist is championing some technology, and I know I used to talk a lot with the guys in the trenches, and if I go talk to a Revit user and they're telling me how, oh my gosh, this is slowing me down, da, 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 I'm like, hey, look, design technology lead, you know, this product that you just told me that I needed to write a check for so we could be a better business, I've listened to the guys in the trenches and they're telling me that it's making them worse at their job. They're slower. We're getting this done before, you know, so there's an interesting dynamic there, and we really understand that dynamic and we lean into it and really try to help the BIM managers and the design technologists. And also if we get the opportunity to meet with the execs, which a lot of times we do. And you know, it's really, I would say that there's the resistance to change. And I think just, and the fast paced, velocity driven domain that we all live in.
What are you currently working on or with, and what will the future have in store for this?
Yeah, currently we're working on a lot of enhancements around our search, because it's such a core piece of the part of the platform. We're also working a lot on advancing our project analytics and content analytics. And then the other one is really it's that non-technical user experience. So as a big part of our web migration, we're really going to open up the platform to where different user experience. If I'm a technical user who's using Revit, then you know I use our product very similar to how I've always used it. We're just simplifying it as much as we can, so that the, you know, right now we have a pretty thick desktop client, and we want to thin that client up, streamline it, and move as much functionality to the web as we can, just to make it easier for the user, maintaining the workflow that they have to have, you know, when they're working in a live Revit session. But also just making more of the platform, more of the power of the platform accessible via a UI experience that's going to resonate depending on with each different persona. Because, you know, a Revit modeler and, you know, someone who's a design technologist, their comfort with the technology and their comfort with the UI is very different than somebody who, you know, is kind of intimidated by technology. And some of the people at the executive level and even the senior design, senior subject matter expert, field superintendent on a job site, you know, or owner operator or a building product manufacturer, you know, they're not accustomed to working in a platform like Revit. So what we have to do is it's the same platform. It's the same engine in the cloud that drives all of this. So we just have to open up more of that to make it more available to the personas who in a format that they can readily consume. And, you know, it's something that makes sense with their existing behaviors to go ahead and lean into it and use it. So that's really, without going into detail on our roadmap, I mean, you know, areas of focus for us, you know, we've got a very scalable platform and it's got a lot of things that it's able to do. And we want to be able to surface more and more of that to not only the technical persona, but also the non-technical persona who needs to engage in workflow, but doesn't want to engage with complex technology.
Dwayne, thanks so much for talking and sharing your knowledge with us. We'd love to have you back for any future upcoming podcast episodes.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm really passionate about what, about the industry, and then really about what Unify, you know, what we aspire to do for it. You know, it's an interesting journey. And I think that's one of the things where we've really focused on is that journey with the customers. And I'm very sensitive to that as a former business owner, and you know, really empathizing with the struggles that it's not only in the design, but when you think about, you know, the owner at the end of the day who probably, you know, a lot of cases has paid for all of this documentation that he receives, but then he's not able to really consume it in a reasonable manner. You know, things get done by hand where they're filling out all the data for their FM system that they want to try to garner the data and wrangle the data from all this information they just received. So between that and really helping people get structure, you know, if we can help people structure ecosystems and they get and where they can govern, validate, and enforce data standard within their own company, the ability to then push that to another known, we've already, I mean, you know, mapping the data is something that our platform is just set up to do. So it's, you know, we've got things that we have to, you know, advance to make that a reality, but you know, we've done POC we did on it, it was a couple of years ago, you know, it can be done. And that's what's really going to get the building product manufacturer, the owner, and the architect, engineer, contractors able to exchange information in a usable manner. So it's not recreated. And, you know, if we can eliminate that inefficiency from the industry, I think it's that's a worthwhile endeavor.
Thanks again. I'd hope to see you at Built Academy Summits in a post-pandemic future.
Looking forward to it.
Great interview there with Dwayne Miller of Unify. I think the thing that hit me the most was that how bright the future is with what Unify is doing and the idea of sharing content and intellectual property without having to recreate that content. I'm really looking forward to those days. Hopefully they're coming soon. What about you, David? What are your thoughts about what Dwayne had to say?
I really enjoyed hearing the story, more specifically the migration from traditional workings to more modern and BIM-orientated workings. He also pointed out one of the biggest issues, I think, in our building industry right now, that being the resistance to change. You could really feel the passion in his voice when he talks about the industry, and overall it's just a very compelling thing to listen to.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit. Your next interview is with Kelly Cohn of ClearEdge 3D. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Kelly before we hop into the interview?
Kelly is passionate about process and technology innovation and how they can change industries and people's lives. With an education in architectural design and documentation, Kelly has implemented various practice technologies into design, estimating and construction teams and workflows. Worked on amazing projects such as Tarang Global Ministry Centre in Seoul as a designer and Renzo Piano's addition to the Lewis Kahn Kimball Art Museum as a contractor. He also had the privilege of growing and leading one of the most talented VDC and process innovation teams in the industry. Now, with ClearEdge 3D, Kelly is putting those experiences to solving problems the building industry faces with technological limitations. With the world filled with new, exciting and sometimes even amazing technologies, the AECO industry often ends last in line to get their hands on them. At ClearEdge, Kelly and team are committed to applying the most recent advancements in reality capture, computer vision and positioning technologies to dramatically improve what can be accomplished in the design and construction of buildings.
Here's Kelly.
Hello, Kelly. Happy New Year. I'd like to welcome you to the show and thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to it.
I'm sure our listeners would love to get to know you a bit better. So how about we start off with a bit about yourself? How did you start off in the industry?
I started life thinking I would be an architect. I really kind of wanted to do that as long as I can remember. You know, did the whole undergrad, grad school thing, got my degrees, and got into the profession and realized that maybe it wasn't quite like the experience in college cracked it up to be. You know, had the usual experience doing bathroom elevations in AutoCAD and all the other really fun stuff. And then just kind of lucked out, and I'd always been passionate about technology, and ended up kind of going that route. Got on a first Revit project we had, and you know, that kind of set everything in motion.
Yeah, I wanted to start off to be an architect too. I think the thing that put me off though was the 7 years. 7 years though.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's different here. It's really, you can do it in five in terms of the education, but then, you know, you've got years of professional practice and all the tests and, you know, I've always been one of those people that just is really driven crazy by things that don't actually add any value or make sense. And I started doing some of my first, preps for those tests. And I realized that those tests had nothing to do with what it actually meant day to day to be an architect. And I was like, I am going to literally spend like 8 years of my life studying for tests that don't mean anything. That's crazy. So yeah. I don't know. I never got licensed, but ended up working on some really fun projects though, even though I didn't get licensed. So you might say it worked out, I guess.
Testing for things you won't use after school is a common theme within modern education systems. But let's not go down that route today. So you touched on how you kind of moved from the architecture route. Do you want to talk about that a bit more? I feel like that's an interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. I, in college, I was building my own computers. I was, you know, one of those people that was experimenting with rendering and using 3D modeling, while other people were pretty happy to stick with physical modeling and, you know, hand drafting. I was always drawn to technology as a tool. And so, when I got into practice, aside from my kind of regular duties, drawing bathroom elevations and whatever else I was asked to do, as an architectural intern, I struck up a good friendship with one of the principals who was very interested in technology. They had kind of brought 3D modeling into the practice at the Beck Group, which is where I went to work after school. It's a design build company in Dallas. You know, it was really interesting kind of hearing what they were working on while I was kind of going through this traditional path. And so then I started experimenting with another one of the, I guess he was an associate principal at the time, one of the lead designers at the firm. They were trying to figure out how to use this Revit thing to produce drawings. And that was really fascinating because as I started experimenting with it a little bit and working side by side with them, I realized, oh, this is how I don't have to draw all these bathroom elevations anymore. They kind of get drawn for me, which, as you can see, was very formative in my career. I guess I keep bringing it up. But we agreed as a firm that it would be a great idea to find a pilot project. And you know, I was just this little intern, a year out of school. And they picked a project. In my head, I didn't think it was a very good project to have picked, but you don't express those things when you're a year out of school. They put us on this job and it turned into a giant, raging, flaming disaster. This is a project that it was like a, I want to say, 40,000 square foot, movie theater, just a couple of screens. It was super fast turnaround, very, efficient. There were templates in CAD, like all this kind of work was done before you ever got to the project. And of course, none of that existed for Revit. And then at the same time, they were just like cycling people through this project like a washing machine. So nobody really got the chance to learn the software long enough to be productive at it. And of course, this is all going through my head as I'm like looking at this project from the inside as the one person that was on it, me and one other guy were on it for, a longer period of time, basically spent all of our time fixing the mistakes that the other people that cycled through made. Anyway, the project was like 400% over budget. I mean, really bad. There was a big meeting at the end of this project, what went wrong and is the technology just not ready for prime time? Because I think the easy thing to do when you have one of these jobs and it goes wrong is you blame the technology, right? You see this a lot of firms when they first try out new things. I was very lucky. Beck was, a very open and flat organization. So we get pulled into this room, principals, principal in charge, project managers, all these people in it. And I'm invited to the room in the first place, which was strange. And then the basically the principal in charge of the firm, after kind of hearing the general report on the project, you know, turned and looked at me and said, "Well, Kelly, what do you think went wrong?" And I was like, we had 9 people work on a project that would normally only be worked on by 2 people. It was worked on for 3 months instead of 3 weeks. And nobody was on the project for more than a week other than me and Lewis while learning new technology. And then, you know, the principal in charge of the theater group, who was responsible for this project, is like sitting right here. You know, I think in a lot of firms that would get you fired. but no, he was just like, "Nope, you're right." So we decided to do one more project. And that one actually went really, really well. We had we made some really smart decisions about staffing on that project, having learned from the last one. Really committed to it. We had the right project manager for it. And that ended up being one of the most profitable projects in the firm's history. So went from, you know, worst to first, you know, on 2 projects. We picked a much better project to take advantage of the technology. So yeah, it kind of just set my career for me, because basically after that, you know, they were like, "All right, well, Kelly, you did such a great job on this project. Do you want to run the Revit implementation nationwide?" And here I am 2 years out of school at this point, running a BIM implementation at a $1 billion company, which is pretty crazy. And that kind of set me down the path. From there, it was like, "Oh, well, we were a design build company. We've got construction. We need to be doing 3D coordination. We have these great 3D models. Why aren't we using them, you know, in construction?" Okay, well, 3D coordination. And then it was, 4D estimating, 4D scheduling, depending on what you think the 4 is on the D. But we did estimating next, we did scheduling, we kind of went down that path. We did some scan to BIM, bought a laser scanner, started up our own scanning group and our own modeling group in kind of under the umbrella of our virtual design and construction team. So over the 10 years I was at Beck, I think we went from, you know, being just me, 2 years in running the BIM implementation, we had basically 20 people by the time I left 10 years later in that virtual design construction. So
that's great.
It was a lot of fun.
You go, advice to everyone, yeah. Stand up to your bosses and shout at them.
Maybe do it a bit more tactfully than I did, though. Just one cautionary tale, a little bit more tactfully.
3% chance.
It's better to have that chance than a chance of getting fired. But you know, it's funny though, because like I think when I made this choice to do the BIM implementation, David, I thought, you know, I was signing away my career as an architect. Right? I was like, "Oh, well, if I go this route, I'm going to be like that geeky CAD manager that gets stuck in a corner, back in the server room. And, I'm doing technical implementations for the rest of my life." And I think one of the things that I was really pleased about and surprised by was that, you know, because we approach the technology implementations from a very business-oriented standpoint, as opposed to a technology-oriented standpoint at Beck. And we were always looking to kind of achieve an ROI, find what is that benefit to the company, to the project. You know, it actually, I think, elevated my position within the firm from a business standpoint pretty dramatically. And that then allowed me to get engaged in some pretty amazing projects that I probably wouldn't have been able to work on had I stayed on that traditional path. So, you know, I worked on this really amazing church in Seoul, South Korea, doing, you know, designing this curtain wall skin with the principal in charge of the entire firm. This is a super high profile project for us, and managing the structural consultant. And then I got to work on the Kimball Art Museum edition, which is a Renzo Piano project. And that's like my hero, right? That's like my living hero architect, right? On a Louis Kahn original project, which is my, you know, dead hero architect. It was like, it was just an amazing set of projects. And those were all things that opened up because I kind of took this path of how do we use technology to be better architects, be better contractors, be better, you know, whatever it was we wanted to do.
So it's cool. Amazing journey. Imagine you would have came across some real challenges that have kept you motivated. things that you had to overcome and you learned from those? Could you tell me a bit about them?
Yeah, I mean, it was never, it was never easy, but it was a lot of fun. I mean, yeah, I'd say one of the things that I really enjoyed and that was a big challenge for us was incorporating reality capture into our kind of practices at Beck. So taking, you know, we'd done a couple jobs where we hired somebody to come in and do laser scanning, and I usually hung out with them in the field while they were doing it so I could learn as much as I could from watching them. You know, we pretty quickly realized this incredible tool, particularly for a design build firm. You know, I think it's really valuable for a design firm and it's really valuable for a construction firm, but for a design build firm, it's like, you know, orders of magnitude more important to do this, right? You know, we kind of did these initial projects, had really good successes, went out and bought a laser scanner, which were frighteningly expensive at the time, and then realized that, you know, the laser scanner was actually not even half of the cost that we were really getting into, because, you know, we very quickly realized, oh, well, there's all these other pieces of software that you need to be efficient and effective. And that's, you know, like the laser scanner is like 120K, all the software is like 50K. And we also very quickly learned we needed an operator for it. Somebody that was maybe a little bit more trained in the field, knew all the different OSHA requirements, things like that, because I was coming from the architecture side. I didn't know all those things. So you add all that together, I mean, it's a pretty big ticket that you sign a company up for. But we put a business plan together, you know, got sign off, went out and bought our scan, started going to town. And oh my gosh, like the scanning is the easy part. The registration is like mind-bogglingly challenging to wrap your head around on large projects. Like, it's so much more complicated than any of the vendors will ever tell you. And then trying to get models out of that is like, there's so much interpretation and industry knowledge and all this other stuff that you have to be able to do a good job of interpreting this data and get a model. And it's really, really slow, a tedious process. And I mean, that's how I ended up where I'm at today, is we ended up buying some different tools and softwares to help with this process. And when I decided it was time to kind of leave Beck and try to do something different, you know, one of those vendors ended up offering me a job, and that's how I ended up at ClearEdge. Their softwares were really, really important for us to be able to do the scan to BIM work efficiently. And then conveniently, it ended up getting me my next gig.
Headways.
Indeed. Well, ClearEdge. And the software that we first started using, was Edgewise, right? So it's basically the thing that makes it different from, I think, all the other scan-to-BIM tools that are out there is just the level of automation. So there's kind of three things you can do to get models from laser scans, right? One of them is manual tracing. Right? You bring the scan in and you start drawing over it, right? You can do that in Revit, do it in AutoCAD, do it in whatever. There's a lot of tools out there that let you do what we would call manual extraction. They call it automated extraction. We call it manual extraction because it's one by one, right? You draw a little window around a pipe in the scan data, and the software algorithmically figures out the size of that pipe and then draws a pipe in the correct place, right? That's the correct size. And that's how, you know, whether it's pipes or beams or equipment or whatever, that's how pretty much all the other tools work. There's this manual identification of what needs to get extracted, and then the software automatically extracts that thing in the background, that one thing, right? The thing that was so cool about the ClearEdge solutions was that identification process was also automated, right? So you can kind of check a couple boxes, click a button, go to sleep, because it does, you know, you're processing gigabytes and terabytes of data. It takes a while. So you really do want to like do it overnight, right? But it will run. And then the next day you get in and it's found, you know, 3,000 pipes for you in your central utility plant and modeled them all for you. And then you click a couple more buttons and you get a connected system, and you basically have like this massive head start. And that's kind of what Edgewise does. Like, it's not going to model all of the pipes for you. It's not the easy button. It misses some pipes because algorithms aren't perfect. It's going to find 55-gallon drums and think they're a pipe. Actually, one of the jobs we did, they had all these pallets of stacked concrete bags, But of course, the end of a concrete bag is round. And so like every one of them, like every pallet had all these pipes on it, but you know, that stuff's easy to clean up. So your process changes a little. You basically have, 4 hours, 6 hours of cleanup as opposed to 3 weeks of manually extracting pipes. So I'll take that. And then you fill out the rest of the stuff. Like you have to go, you know, you'll take that, pull it into Revit, and then put in your valves and your equipment and all those other things the way you normally would. But yeah, that's Edgewise in a nutshell. And so that's a really cool software for Scan2Bem. But one of the things I was really interested in as I was kind of in my last couple of years at Beck was how do we do construction QA/QC? Because as I discovered working on a job site for a year and a half, stuff doesn't get put in the right place a shocking amount of time. And a lot of times you don't even know about it until it's way, way, way too late. And then there's problems, there's schedule delays, like this really terrible thing that happens on every job everywhere in the world. And how could you fix that, right? You know, I'd been doing all this scanning stuff. We'd done all this modeling stuff. And so I'd been talking to the people at ClearEdge about, hey, could you take these algorithms, these fancy things you've written to find pipes? Could you use it to instead look at what's supposed to be there from a 3D model and compare it to what's actually installed in a point cloud? And so, you know, I'd been begging for this for 3 or 4 years. And then that last probably 6 months I was at Beck, we were actually actively alpha and beta testing this new product, Verity, that was kind of built on that idea. And so when I left, that was the thing I got hired to do, was to actually bring that software to market. So I then spent, my first year and a half, probably first 16 months at ClearEdge, bringing Verity to market. And so, what that does, right, is take a 3D model, take a point cloud, and then basically gets the model to match the point cloud. As built it, tells you whether stuff is installed, tells you how accurately it's installed. And you can do that for, I just got a vendor in India to generate a 3D model off of a laser scan, and I want to make sure they did a good job and met the specs. You can do that, use that to make sure that the subcontractor is installing all of their ductwork in the correct location and they're not messing up another trade's work. So there's a lot of different uses for that kind of model comparison technology. So that's our other big bit of kit. And then we kind of got a little brother to that, which is Rhythm, which specifically does that kind of work on concrete slabs for floor flatness or beam deflection if you're pouring a concrete slab on top of steel beams. But it's really targeted at that kind of concrete subcontractor or general contractors that are working with concrete projects. But that's kind of a little very focused bit of software that we've got. But yeah, those are our three bits of kit at ClearEdge that I guess one way or another, I'm responsible for now.
So how do these stack up against other clash detection softwares? For example, right now, I'm learning a bit about Navisworks and clashing within models there.
Yeah, so I mean, we don't actually do any clash detection. What we do is we do that comparison. And so we're actually integrated with Navisworks. So we see Navisworks as kind of like a partner in that regard. So we get the geometry and the point clouds that are in Navisworks, do the comparison, and then we will as built the geometry in Navisworks. So we actually then move the geometry in Navisworks to the as built location, and then you can rerun your clash detection in Navisworks, right? So we have, we're using these computer vision algorithms to basically automate that process of as building a model to the installed conditions. And as a result of having done that, we can give you all this interesting data about what is and isn't installed, how far off it is it out of the tolerance that you've set, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we work hand in hand with Navisworks. We are, working on other integrations with other tools. And then we also have a lot of integrations with the kind of issue management stuff, right? So BIMTrack and M360 and Procore. So, we're also trying to then, here's these issues. Well, now we need to push them into these platforms so that it can go to resolution, right? We need to make an RFI out of this. Well, all right, send it to Procore as an observation and then take that observation and flag it as an RFI and voila, you have your your kind of paper chain in place to get an engineer to sign off on the fact that the beam was put in 12 inches to the right of where it was supposed to be, which if that was the smallest deviation I'd seen, I would be super happy because I've seen worse.
It's a cool insight though. The difference is there that it's not really like a competing software. It's a partnership. I'd see that now. It's cool.
Yeah, well, and this industry is full of, you know, partnerships. It's a small world. So like, you know, we actually got acquired. Clearage got acquired a couple of years ago by Topcon. And so for people that don't know the geospatial universe, there's basically three companies. There's Trimble, Topcon, and Leica, right? Which is owned by Hexagon. So I guess it's Trimble, Topcon, and Hexagon now. But those are the three big companies that make pretty much all of the optical equipment that's used by the construction industry, whether it's horizontal or vertical. And so we were this little independent shop, and you know, prior to the acquisition, and we worked with everybody's laser scanners, right? You know, we didn't make our own laser scanners. So whether it was Trimble's or Leica's or Topcon's or Pharos, which is a metrology company, but they also make laser scanners. CNF, which is a fabrication company that makes laser scanners. But we worked with everybody's stuff. And Trimble was actually our biggest sales channel. And then Topcon acquired us. And I think, you know, we were very nervous that, you know, what would this mean? You know, would people tell us we couldn't use their instruments anymore? But, you know, I think fortunately, businesses are run by rational people that aren't just up there making emotional decisions. So no, nothing crazy happened. In fact, Trimble, you go to their website, you can still find our software on their website. And we actually just launched a partnership with Leica, which is, you know, the other big one. So, you know, Leica now has a version of our Verity software that works with their Jetstream point cloud distribution package. So, you know, and I think this kind of speaks, you asked what makes our software unique earlier, and it's this kind of these computer vision algorithms that really automate parts of the process. You know, we've really carved out a niche in that, so much so that our biggest competitors resell our software because we're the only ones that really do that really robustly. So, you know, you can buy, effectively, you can buy ClearEdge software through either Topcon, Trimble, or Leica now. So anyone you buy your instruments from, you can buy our software through them. And we love when you buy directly from us too.
You win every time.
But, not every time. Not everybody needs automation, I guess. But, you know, I've never understood why people will. I think there's this like people want an easy button. And so I think people sometimes see our software and they think it's an easy button. And then they're disappointed that it's not. And, you know, there's kind of an emotional like, you know, oh, it should do all these things. It's like, yeah. Okay, it should. I wish it did. But, you know, why would you want to start on your own 20-yard line? I'm using an American football reference. Why would you want to start on your own 20-yard line as opposed to starting out on the other team's 20-yard line? I mean, if we can get you 70 to 80% of your pipes modeled for you, yeah, you got to do a little cleanup and you got to finish it. But I wouldn't want to just start from the beginning instead because it doesn't get every last thing right, you know? But yeah, not everyone necessarily agrees with that rationale, I guess. Sometimes people are like, no, you know, it doesn't do this and it doesn't do this. So we, you know, we're not going to buy it. I'm like, but you can get a return on your investment on one project. Like not many technologies give you that. Like that's pretty rare that you can actually pay for the software on one job. Like that's just saying, but you know, c'est la vie.
But no, I can see both sides of that argument. I guess it's just, as we talked about earlier, blame the software, you know?
It is easy to blame the software. Yeah. Well, and there's so much complexity in the reality capture world. Like there's all these different formats and there's all these kind of nuances, and that's, you know, one of the things we also do. We never just give out free trials of our software. We always couple a trial with training, because if you bring point clouds in from the wrong format, then a lot of the automation can't work because it doesn't have the data in it. And the easiest thing I can make is like, you know, if you talk to a client, they don't know the difference between an RVT file and a DWG file a lot of times, right? It's just some computer file you hand them, right? But we know the difference. We know that one is just a bunch of lines with no data. And then the other one is a bunch of 3D geometry that's, you know, got all this, you know, data associated with the pieces of geometry. They're radically different in terms of what you can do with them. but they're just little files, right? And the same thing's true in laser scans. There's structured laser scan data, which has all this additional useful, valuable information. And then there's unstructured data, which is just a bunch of points in space. And you give us that, there's not a lot we can do with it. You give us the structured stuff, we can do a lot of things. And people just have trouble understanding that, I think, the first time they get into it. And so I think a lot of times people take the wrong data into the software and they're like, this doesn't work. Well, yeah, it's garbage in, garbage out.
Let's move on. So we talked about things you've overcome in the past. Is there anything now that you are currently facing that is kind of having a damper on the innovation in technology at the moment?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's kind of three sources how shall we call it, resistance or friction to innovation, and kind of three, and in turn, three opportunities, right? One of the things I was always told by kind of staff members that I would hire up and bring into the virtual design group at Beck, and now I tell my team at Clear, just anytime there's friction, anytime there's resistance, there's also opportunity, right? So, you know, there's kind of this internal resistance to change, and this is a very emotional thing with people, right? Particularly in high stress situations, and so there's this kind of resistance to adopting new processes and new technologies that you'll find in firms. People, I mean, you hear this all the time, right? Well, I've always done it this way, or, you know, this is the way we've always done it. There are various different flavors of that phrase. And that's, anytime you hear that from somebody, what they're really saying is, I'm scared. You're asking me to do something different and new. I don't know how it's going to work. Therefore, I'm uncomfortable doing it because I know how this other thing's going to work. And I know I can get my job done in the time that I have budget. If I do this new thing, I don't know that. And it's scary, right? And, you know, that's a valid fear because they have a deadline and they have a contract and there's expectations. And so it's not that their fear is not valid. And so it's like the onus is on us as technologists to prove to them that, oh no, what I'm asking you to do will allow you to do that and get it done in half the time, thus giving you double the profit margin on that chunk of work that we deliver, right? Or whatever the kind of business case is. But it's on us to explain and help, you know, alleviate that fear. But that kind of internal resistance to change, you know, I call this kind of the process or, you know, I'm trying to think of a better word for it, but basically firms have processes and these processes are based on the existing tools and technologies and experience of their staff. And they've been built, you know, these processes have been built in a very evolutionary manner over decades, right? And so when new technologies become available, usually parts of those processes are unnecessarily inefficient, because they aren't taking advantage of these new technologies and new capabilities. And so, you know, making that change though can seem really hard because people don't like change, right? So that's kind of a fundamental nut to crack that I think when you are in the business of, you know, practice technology or process change, whatever you want to call it, that's kind of the thing you bump your head against a lot. But I actually think that's probably the smallest opportunity to make an impact overall, because those processes do constantly evolve and change and trend towards efficiency. So things will get better a little bit at a time, but they'll get better and they'll be lagging the technology, but they'll only be lagging it by 5 to 20 years, which sounds terrible when you're like in it. But when you kind of pull out of it and look at the broader spectrum, you realize that that's actually not that bad. I think the bigger, kind of going up a step in opportunity, and this is why I decided to leave Beck ultimately and go into the kind of technology, basically, you know, it's like, instead of using tools, making tools. The reason I decided to go into that is our industry is really slow to get new technology. And so there's also this kind of technology gap that exists where there are things that are technologically possible, but there is no solution to bring it to the industry, right? So think about robotic construction, stuff that you see in horizontal construction all the time, right? Bulldozers that drive themselves because they have GPS, you know, there's all this kind of technology that's available in sister or adjacent industries. There's all sorts of crazy stuff in automotive, all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, on robotics. How do we bring those technologies into solutions that are targeted at the AEC industry? Because I actually think there's a lot more productivity and efficiency on the table that we could gain by better leveraging technology that's broadly available in the universe, but getting it in a form that's applicable to our industry. But that's not even the worst thing. The worst thing is actually legal and contracts. Like, the biggest inhibitor to innovation in our industry is contracts. Contracts seem to lag what's technologically possible by centuries, not just a decade. And they are just, they actually, in my experience, unlike processes, which I think evolve towards efficiency naturally, you know, even without good guidance, they just naturally evolve that way. Legal contracts seem to devolve towards inefficiency when just left to cycle through courts and everything else. They just get worse. They just get worse over time. And then it takes like a pretty major, oh, let's try this IPD thing, and we're going to create and invent an entirely new contract structure and language. And it's going to take 50 years before the industry really starts adopting it in mass, broadly. And then IPD itself will devolve towards inefficiency, and somebody else will have to come up with a new, you know, a new contract to replace that. But I think that I don't want to mess with that. I don't like reading lawyer language. So I'm going to cap myself at this level of impact. I'm going to make tools, not fix contracts.
It's pretty sad, but I imagine most of the contracts aren't really in favor of the technology either. They're not kind of encouraging it. It's more about the people and not the technology, which is sad.
You know, contracts are there for a reason, right? They're there for when things go wrong, right? But this is why they devolve, because, you know, gosh, this went wrong on this job, sometimes involving some new technology. Oh, somebody gets sued. Somebody loses a lot of money. New language is added into contracts. And I mean, you know, the big challenge, that one of the big challenges we have with BIM, right, is, and people have always heard this, you know, BIM, the model is not a contract document. That basically means that the drawings win. So if the architect has a great Revit model, and then on the 2D drawings, they did a bunch of field regions and drafting, and those two things disagree, even if the Revit model is better and the Revit model is right, the contractor is legally obligated to follow the 2D details that are wrong, right? And it's just like, oh, why? But contracts. Autodesk launched this really cool cloud solution where architects and engineers and contractors could all collaborate, and technically can collaborate in the same 3D file. You literally could have a unified BIM, you know, in the cloud through Autodesk's current technology. You know how many companies are doing that? Zero. Because lawsuits, contracts. So a lot of times technology is way ahead of contracts. And so, you know, that's a challenge. That's a challenge when choosing technology to develop, because like, we've had some good ideas that we just know not to put time and money towards because nobody will be able to buy them, because you can't implement them on a real project. I think it's a challenge a lot of startups have. A lot of startups don't even have people with AEC industry experience. So they're like, oh, it'd be so cool to do this. And it is. And they do it. And then they try and take it to the market. And people are like, that's really cool, but we can't use it because we can't let the contractor get involved in this part of the process because it would be a violation of contract. So it's just, it's contracts. Gosh, that's depressing. Let's change the subject.
Yeah, let's steer back to some questions. What are you working on?
Now let's bring up another contract, non-disclosure agreements. gosh, you know, we've got a lot of stuff that we're working on right now that we really can't talk about yet. And I'm really excited about some of it. So I'm really bummed because, you know, particularly with y'all, like, I would love to talk about it. Like I said, we just launched the Leica thing, which I'm super excited about. We've got a, we also just launched some new releases of Rhythm. It's got some really nice speed and performance improvements. Edgewise, we just launched with Cable Tray. Actually, we haven't launched yet. We're launching in like 2 weeks with Cable Tray. So Edgewise, as I mentioned, does a lot of automation, right? But it's very focused. We can't automate everything because every one of these algorithms is like a bespoke, custom coded thing that takes years to get right. So, you know, we do pipes, we do structure, we do rectangular duct work. And when I say pipes, I mean, we do round things. So it's like, you know, pipes, conduit, round duct, you know, round things, round MEP systems, I guess I should say. But we've had a lot of people that wanted us to do cable tray because they are kind of common. And so we've spent literally like the last 2 years figuring out how to do cable tray. So we've got a cable tray module launching this month, which I'm super excited about. And maybe it'll be February. But I can definitely talk about that. And I think our next big thing that we've kind of broadcast a little bit is we're taking Verity and integrating it with Revit. And so I mentioned earlier that, you know, the technology can be used for a lot of things. One of the kind of surprising uses that we saw was companies were able, that were doing Scan2Bim, were able to basically take their modeling process and parallelize it with their scanning process. So they could go and start modeling off 2D drawings like walls and things like that. And then they basically could take that, pull it into Navisworks, run Verity once they had their scans, and they'd get a report of any walls that they needed to go and change. But then they would have to manually go change those in Revit because we can only ask build them in Navis, and that doesn't really help anybody outside of 3D coordination. So we were getting a lot of pressure to take that and bring it into Revit. So we're working on that now. And so I'm hoping sometime in 2021, knock on wood, we should be able to ship that. And so that's really cool because then it basically opens up true as-building as an opportunity. So, or automated as-building, as I guess I should say. Because then what we'll be able to do is inside of Revit, you know, you bring in the scans and you can basically go, all right, click a button, go get lunch, come back, and here's all the walls that don't match the laser scan. And, you know, whether that's your Scan2Bim company and you're trying to generate a model, and of course Verity works with any geometry, not just pipes and structure, things like that. So it's like, oh, walls, pumps, equipment, I don't care, anything, have it find where it is, and then you click a button and it'll move it to where it is. And, you know, as much as is possible, keep systems and things like that connected, right? Which you can't do in Navisworks because there is no system in Navisworks. So that's really exciting. But also, if you're an architect that's gone through the entire design process and the contractor goes out and does a laser scan when it's time to build, you could bring that in and short cycle that whole RFI process of kind of figuring out what's there. Or after the project gets built on new construction, be able to go out and scan and then turn over an accurate as-built to your owner based on the scan data. So super, super excited about that. That's the thing I'm most excited about probably right now that I can talk about. But yeah, that's going to be really, really fun. So really looking forward to getting that out.
Sounds fun. No, it's actually quite exciting hearing things like this because the way we're learning right now is that after you've done your class through Navisworks, you have to go back through and do it all manually, which, you know, works.
It works, but then the contractor doesn't even put it in where they're supposed to, and then you get clashes in the field that you weren't expecting because, you know, this is in the wrong place. So they installed the duct 3 inches lower than it showed in the drawings. And then it's, you know, it's the curse of the 3D coordination process. The field has been, it spent so many years just building it the way it makes sense to them and using the drawings as a guide rather than using the drawings as like, you know, a Bible. The drawings are it should kind of go here, not a, it should go precisely here. That's kind of the mindset. And that just means that, you know, 3D coordination, the value of that to an organization is not as high as it could be, right? And so part of, you know, changing that mindset's important. It really is important to change that mindset. And interestingly, what we found is the best way to change that mindset is to let them know that you're actually watching where they really do put stuff. Because I guarantee you, after they put the first couple things in, just the way they want to put them in using the drawings as the guide. And you got scanned, you run it through Verity, you find out that no, in fact, these pipes are not in the right place, and you go make them move them. The next time they put in pipes, they put them in the right place. Nobody likes going back and redoing work.
The budget doesn't look much either.
No, but the good news is if you do it once, yeah, it hurts on that one. But if all the rest of the stuff goes in right, then you don't have all the downstream mistakes, which also come out of budget, right? When their pipes are in the wrong place and somebody else has prefab stuff that they have to field modify, and you get a change, you know, you get a charge for that, right? So it just, it results in a more efficient, more cost-effective system if people know you're watching and they actually put stuff in right. But that's assuming you did the 3D coordination right, so.
Kaylee, unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I think it's time to close up. I want to thank you for coming in and sharing your knowledge and experiences with us. We'd love to have you back in the future for some upcoming episodes.
I'm game. You know, obviously, I'm always happy to talk. No, I had a blast. It's a lot of fun. You know, I think I got really, really lucky. I found a great company to go to work for at Beck. They really let me stretch my wings. And, you know, I think they were very technology forward. And it opened up a lot of opportunity to do some really fun stuff. And, you know, I deserve very little credit for that opportunity. I think all I did was just take as much advantage of it as I possibly could. Yeah. Hey, you know, if the door's open, walk through it. Right. But yeah, I think it's an interesting industry. And the one thing I'd throw out there is that, you know, don't assume that going down the path of technology is a life sentence, so to speak. You know, you don't have to be the CAD manager stuck in the server room for the next 40 years of your career. You know, I think if you treat technology appropriately, which is that it's a tool, that's what it is. Technology is just another tool, you know, and its purpose is to accomplish the business objectives. And I think if you can, you know, keep that in your mind as a technologist, as you're helping firms get the best use of technology, you know, I think that actually opens up a lot of opportunities to do things that maybe you wouldn't have had the opportunity to do if you stayed on a traditional career path, whether that's a better compensation, whether that's being able to go work on the software side of things for a while, whether that's being able to work on some really cool projects because you are an expert in the technology. I just think there's a lot of opportunities there if you can find something like technology to really help differentiate yourself. So if it's something you enjoy, you know, wade into it or
very
jump
broad
into
spectrum
it.
Of things you can do in this industry. Probably lots more you've done as well that we could hopefully talk about next time.
I'm game. Send me an invite.
All right. Well, until next time, thanks again. And hopefully I can see you at another Built Academy Summit in a post-pandemic future. Fingers crossed.
Yes. Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. It will come soon. Probably not this year, but maybe if we're lucky. But definitely next year. So, Built Academy 2022.
Right. Thanks, Kaylee.
All right. See you later. And thank you all very much.
I could listen to Kelly talk all day. He has such a great storytelling way of purveying his knowledge to the industry, and there's always several nuggets of wisdom in everything that he says. Even if at the end of this story he decided to tell us that we shouldn't yell at our boss to get ahead in the world, even if he did. but really, truly, he's a wealth of knowledge when it comes to scanning and scanning technology, and just glad that he was able to come in here and you were able to talk to him, David. What about you? What did you learn from your time with Kelly?
I had a lot of fun in that interview. Again, another great story. We spoke a lot about ClearEdge and Edgewise, and I found that so interesting, but that's probably because I'm a complete software geek.
You and me both, David, and I think a lot of our listeners are. Where does the time go? We're here at the end of another episode, which has been a great episode, listening about these two great innovators that took very different paths to get where they were, to solve a problem where there wasn't currently a solution out there. Just before we wrap up, David, you'll also be leading next month's episode. Can you tell us what you're going to be working on already? Give us a little sneak peek.
are currently tinkering on two compelling episodes on robotics where we shine a light on academical researches and industrial demand-driven approaches with leading European institutes in robotics and mechatronics.
Well, I can say I'm very much looking forward to the next two episodes, that's for sure. So in closing, we would like to thank our podcast technology sponsor, BIMTRACK, for their continued support of the Built Academy, as well as Peter Yosel for his intro music he's provided to us for the podcast. And don't miss our next episode airing on February 25th. Please like, share, rate, and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. Until then, on behalf of the Built Academy team, thank you for listening and stay curious.